This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Developed heart disease. We've known some of this for a long, long time. It's just been kind of hidden in the on the dust shelves in scientific libraries.
Go ahead, Dr. Campbell.
So as we sort of got caught up in this as a whole society, more and more protein, what that also meant, as we were consuming, you know, basically a lot of animal foods to get that protein, what we also learned was that the other nutrients, so-called nutrients that come along with the animal-based foods or that are basically diminished by not consuming enough plant-based foods, what we also learned that all those other nutrients play in this same game. By increasing protein, for example, animal foods, we decrease the consumption of the antioxidants that are present in plant-based foods. We decrease the complex carbohydrates. We change the level of fat. So everything is going wrong, and it's just going to hell in a handbasket, basically. So my research, and we've probed this question in great depth in the laboratory, working inside of cells, if you will, inside of bodies, obviously, thinking of it in that context, in a broad context. And what we also learned was that 10% level that has been long recommended and accepted as plenty enough protein, one can get that protein from a whole food plant-based diet. That's simple. A lot of people didn't even know that protein was in plants all that much, at least for a long time. And that protein is plenty. And it turns out that level of protein is not just the protein. I have to emphasize that, not just the protein, but it's actually the combination of all the things that come along because of our reverence for that protein. That's really what the question is. And so now, so I wrote the book in the China study, got to the end of it and said, here's the data. I don't like to preach and proselytize. I just wanted to present the information that we learned, you know, from the taxpayer money and go back to tell the taxpayers, here's what we learned. It was up to them to decide when they wanted to believe it, if they wanted to try it, whatever. So that's been up 9 years now. The book has done extremely well, and people have tried it and have seen the results. They're amazing. The effects of consuming a plant-based diet are immediate, almost immediate, within a week or two. And the effects are very broad in scope. Cholesterol comes down. Bad cholesterol comes down. Blood pressure levels can be corrected. Blood sugar levels get changed. Body weight falls off. And the whole process of disease formation is slowed down or reversed. It really is quite amazing.
Established
that effect in the China study, then the book Whole, which just came out, was my attempt to try to understand why. Why is it we haven't known this, you know, for the decades and even centuries? And what can we learn from the science itself that might have led us and allowed us to believe otherwise? So that's what the Whole is all about.
So in Whole, you talk about the difference between holism in its approach to science and the approach of reductionism. Can you tell us a little bit or define the two terms for us so that people can understand your critique of the way science is missing the big picture?
Yeah, let me start off by first saying I have rearranged the spelling of holism. It's not H-O-L-I-S-M as in the dictionaries. I've added the W in front of it because that's really, for me, what it really means. It's W-H-O-L-I-S-M. So that's what I'm talking about. But in any case, we have been encumbered and focused on the idea that nutrition comes from the effects of individual nutrients. We specify exactly the amounts we ought to be eating or make these specific kinds of recommendations. And we identify each nutrient one by one by its name, by its function, and so forth and so on. I know this very well because I taught myself nutrition for many years, taught upper class course in nutritional biochemistry at Cornell University. I was doing the same thing, but there was always something that was troubling me. It really had to do with the interactions between nutrients. It had to do with the effect, what is the likely effect when you think of them together. That means whole foods. Whole foods, we can specify how much nutrients supposedly are in whole foods, although we miss the mark almost all the time. But in any case, we can specify those numbers, but we've overemphasized that. That's not the point. That's really not the point. If one is just eating these whole plant-based foods, vegetables, fruits, grains, legumes, and so forth and so on, we don't need to get caught up in these details. And just to illustrate one of the consequences of that, we have a vitamin supplement industry that's entirely focused on you know, what individual nutrients can do. We now know they don't work. They don't work in spite of the, you know, billions of dollars we're spending, you know, on those products. And besides, it's a cruel hoax, because when we're trying to obtain health from vitamin supplements, we're then avoiding what we ought to really be doing, and that is basically consuming whole plant-based foods. I mean, it's really remarkable when you start looking inside of the cell, and that's where I spent much of my early years, looking at this amazing sort of complexity that's inside of each of our 10-plus trillion cells in our body. Each cell is like a universe. It's like a universe. And all of this, just enormous complexity inside the cell. If we look at just one thing at a time, that's not going to give us the answer. That's the sort of the details.
Well, Dr. Campbell,
put it together. Yeah.
That was actually one of my favorite parts of your book, Whole, in the sense that, you know, you look at how much vitamin C people are getting in their diet, we make the false assumption that taking vitamin C is going to give us the health benefit when it may be something else in a very complex food that vitamin C is just a marker for. But to go farther and say that it's all a hoax and none of it works seems a little extreme. And I wonder, I mean, obviously, like if you have iron deficiency and you take iron, or if you take folic acid to prevent neural tube defects, or if you take B12 because you have megaloblastic anemia, those are all individual nutrients that will actually improve health benefits.
Yes, you're absolutely right. What is the basis for the vitamin supplement industry? And I know that quite well because I was the one who was the principal person giving witness to this in Federal Trade Commission hearings at the beginning of the industry. So I've really paid close attention to it and thought a great deal about it. What happens when we test these individual nutrients? Yes, it's true. We can see results that look promising. And much of those results that we thought were promising had nothing more to do than just simply increasing their levels in the blood. That's not an adequate, you know, observation. That doesn't tell us anything, because we can maybe increase it higher than it should be. But in any case, we can see these results oftentimes. They look impressive. We can get excited about it. On one hand, but what the consequence of that is, do they really decrease the risk of diseases, you know, the more serious diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, whatever, do they do that over the long term? The answer is no. That's the results that we now have. It doesn't work that way. And so when you start thinking about it a little more, we find out that what we're doing, we're taking these individual nutrient supplements, assuming that we're gaining some great benefits, and in the process, it's a hoax. It's a cruel hoax, because then we don't pay attention to the message that we should be paying attention to, namely to use whole food plant-based diets.
Well, I certainly think it's true that if you eat a food that's rich in vitamin C, it's going to be a better health benefit for you than taking the supplement.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways, and probably will prove to have those benefits in terms of cardiovascular disease. But some of these individual nutrients do treat actual diseases, whether, again, say anemia, for instance, they actually address it and can cure it.
Well, yeah, there are iron, of all the various minerals and vitamins, of course, I think the case for iron is probably one of the better cases one might find, but again, most of the iron deficiency problems can be traced to other problems, particularly in third world. It can be traced to parasitism. It's really traced to parasitism. So, and if we're eating, we're eating the animal-based foods, the wrong diet, it's going to actually exacerbate that particular kind of problem. And we in China, when we did this nationwide survey there, and we measured iron status in six different ways. Iron, serum iron, ferritin, so forth, and iron binding capacity, so forth and so on. We found really no evidence of iron deficiency problems.
But
that's just one study.
But certainly in the United States, iron deficiency is also just from women who lose a lot of iron from heavy menstruation, too.
Yeah, I know, but at the same time, I can't speak to too much in detail as far as the iron question is concerned, but if one gets on a whole food plant-based diet, these kind of problems don't occur. I would ask you or anyone to go to the literature and find for me evidence that when one is doing a whole food plant-based diet right, to find for me the evidence that shows that kind of diet is deficient in iron and all these problems arise.
we're talking today
I will assure you, it's hard put to find that. So the problems that we tend to see that might, in fact, in the short run, look like they're causing corrections, is because the people are eating the wrong kind of diet to begin with. So the best case that can be made for some of these supplements is that it's kind of patching up. It's patching up some problems that's created by the wrong diet in the first place. Correct the diet, then that issue goes away.
We're talking today with T. Colin Campbell, the author of Whole, Rethinking the Science of Nutrition. You're listening to Health Watch on KBOO, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 503-231-8187. So, Dr. Campbell, you mentioned some of the health benefits of going on a plant-based diet. How do you incorporate some of the information, the scientific studies that are coming out now that on a very different diet, so the diet that is mostly vegetables and animal protein and a restriction of grains that are also showing a reduction in blood pressure, a reduction in cholesterol, and a better glucose control?
Yeah, let me take that separately. The one concerning your question concerning grains on one hand, and the other concerning the high consumption of animal protein and fat, if you will, the Atkins type of diet. It turns out, again, I would suggest that anyone who really wants to look at this information, the evidence that supposedly is showing advantage for the high-protein, high-fat diet, like the Atkins diet, for example, and a number of other sort of variations of the theme, that evidence that we're reading about, makes the headlines in newspapers, is false, because those studies that they're quoting are basically comparing an Atkins-like experience, high-protein, high-fat, with, let's say, the normal diet, okay? And the normal diet already is high in protein and fat. So the Atkins type of approach increases these levels of nutrients even higher under those circumstances, and that in turn creates basically a ketotic kind of condition, which causes total calorie consumption to go down somewhat. People will lose weight on that kind of diet, no question about that. It's been consistently shown. But it doesn't last because, for one thing, it doesn't last in a fairly short period of time. And this is information coming from the Atkins community. Bad breath increases, for example, and all sorts of those headaches increase. They're much higher, you know, than even this already bad diet in the first place. If you go to a whole food plant-based diet, in contrast, you don't get these problems. They disappear. And so the studies that are being used to tout the advantages of the high-protein, high-fat diets are studies comparing their effects against the so-called standard American diet, which already is not right. And the level of fat, just to give you an indication, the standard American diet has around 35% or so of total calories as fat. The Atkins diet might argue, or in some of these cases, it should be as high as 40 or 50 or even 60%. That has nothing to do with the kind of diet I'm talking about. The diet I'm talking about 10% fat, not 30%. And they're talking about, you know, really high levels of protein, which is maybe 100% more protein than we've already shown is adequate and is recommended, whereas the plant-based diet is 10% protein. So in all those studies that are being cited, not one of those studies have actually compared against a whole food plant-based diet, low in fat and protein.
So could you then...
I have to say, I'm sorry to use any strong words, but basically that's a fraud. That's a fraud, the way this has been manipulated. And the information that comes out is pleasing to people because they'd like to hear good things about the bad habits. That's what it comes down to.
But those diets aren't easy to do either. I mean, there are people having to avoid alcohol and bread and pasta and rice.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And potatoes. So, I mean, those aren't actually diets that are really, like, confirming their bad habits necessarily.
Yes. As I said, I wanted to separate my comment into two different categories. Well, I just spoke about the high protein, high fat thing. Now you're raising the question concerning, let's say, the carbohydrates, especially the refined carbohydrates, I would suggest. It is absolutely true. When we consume, we're consuming much too much of the refined carbohydrates. And basically, just say that the other way around, refined carbohydrates is the carbohydrate taken out of plants and refined, if you will, away from the fiber and other good things that are there. So we end up with white flour. We end up with, you know, all the pastas that are made from that. We end up with a lot of sugar out of the plants. That's not what I'm talking about. That is a problem. There is no question about that. And so we consume too much of the refined carbohydrates. But in reality, when one is consuming a whole food plant-based diet with the fat and protein and other things in the right proportion, at that point in time, about 80% of the total calories are from carbohydrate. But it's all natural. It's different. And one of the really tragic things that's happened in science over the years is that these people want to argue, for example, with a low-carb diet. That's what they keep talking about. They don't tell you, they don't tell the public that what they're really talking about is refined carbohydrates. That's what they should be saying. Because what is learned about that sort of thing is extrapolated to mean all carbohydrates. That's nonsense. That simply is nonsense.
I think that's a good point.
You've got to start telling the truth.
That's definitely a good point, and I think it's the one area of agreement between people who are eating a vegetarian or vegan diet and the people eating or purporting a paleo diet is the removal of the refined carbohydrates. Not all carbohydrates, but the fact that refined carbohydrates are considered bad for health.
I should say one thing. I'm not talking about vegan diets and vegetarian diets. I never used the word vegan one time in the China study. I'm really not, because you know all the vegetarians and vegans are sort of going in the right direction, yes, and we see some benefits from that. The fact of the matter is about 90% of so-called vegetarians are still using a lot of dairy and oftentimes eggs and maybe fish and stuff like that. So the nutrient composition of a vegetarian diet is not that different from the standard American diet. So therefore, we can't expect to see much gain by being a vegetarian, at least for 90% of them. So then you can ask the question, well, what about vegans? I mean, it seems like they're going in the right direction, according to what I'm saying. No animal foods, if you will. The problem with vegans, they are making their choices for ideological reasons for the most part, not for science. They didn't think too much about health, but they're at least in the past. So they're using a kind of diet just to avoid animal products. Fair enough. There's a good enough reason. But what they end up doing is using a lot of processed foods that are made up such that they're high in fat, high in refined carbohydrates, and a lot of vegans can be kind of in a mess. They're not necessarily gaining that much. So I'm not advocating vegetarian or vegan diets whatsoever. I just don't. I don't go there. I'm talking about a low-fat, whole-food, plant-based diet.
But you're also advocating a diet that has no animal products, correct?
Yes, I am. Yep.
And you mentioned at the beginning that you think that there's a lot of evidence around a link between animal protein and cancer. However, there's a lot of people who've looked at the same data that you've put forth in the China study and also at the rat studies that you did and you reference in India and come up with very different conclusions. So
that's wrong. I know who you're talking about, and I don't want to use her name on the she lives out your way. And she spouted off this stuff, and she talks about the fact that there's alternative data showing that high-protein diets actually prevent cancer. She's referring to a study that, and others have picked up on this, she's referring to a study from India in the beginning that showed a high-protein diet basically reducing the acute toxicity of aflatoxin or the carcinogen. That's true. That's what they did. I knew that from the 1960s onwards. And so we investigated that question. Of course, those people want to ignore that or they lie about it. And so we investigated that question, published the information. It was supported by NIH. And what really is the case, if one is given a really high dose of a carcinogen, I don't care what it is, we're going to see acute toxicities, we say. You know, immediate, serious toxicity. It might even be deadly in many cases. And so under those circumstances, the body is wrestling with the idea of, let's get rid of this. So detoxification has to come into play. And the enzyme that's largely involved in that is benefited by a higher protein diet. So a higher protein diet for that immediate large burst of exposure to a carcinogen, yes. I mean, that makes altogether good sense. But that's not the way cancer really forms. Cancer forms from the lower dosage level over longer periods of time, in which case then if you're consuming a high protein diet, you actually increase the genetic mutations that actually occur. So that story about...
I'm not sure who you're referring to, but that doesn't really matter. A couple of things that I read, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them. One was that in the rat study where the rats got more cancer on the high-protein diet, those were also the rats that tended not to live as long, that they didn't make far fewer of them made it in terms of mortality to the end of the year. And then also...
Well, of course, they all died of cancer. That's why they didn't live.
No, that the low-protein people, low-protein rats died the high protein rats got cancer, but the
that's absolutely false.
But the high protein rats actually survived a lot longer, even though they had cancer.
No, that's not true. Absolutely unabashedly false. It's 100% wrong because the animals are given a lower protein diet. The normal lifetime of an animal is 2 years, right? In 2 years' time, every single one of those animals given a low protein diet were still living with no cancer. And they actually had consumed a little more calories. They were very healthy. They were thrifty. They were, you know, just involuntary physical activity was pretty amazing. That's the low protein. They did not die early. In fact, at that same point in time, the animals given a higher protein diet were all dead with cancer.
And what
I don't
about
understand that kind of criticism? That's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, no, I don't have the data in front of me, so that's why I brought it up. But another respected epidemiological researcher on nutrition, Walter Willett, has looked at the China study and hasn't found the same correlations between animal protein and cancer. Do you have any thoughts on his critique?
Yes, because the Nurses' Health study, and I know that very well. I also know Professor Willett. He's an excellent researcher. He's got a good team. They publish extensively the Nurses' Health study. You know, has had a cohort, has been very interesting in some of the results they get. The only problem with that particular study is that all of those people really are consuming a relatively high protein, high fat diet. And so it's like comparing, you know, 4 packs of cigarettes a day versus 3 packs a day. It's that kind of thing where sort of everybody's kind of maxed out. There's no one in a Nurses' Health study, no one who is consuming the kind of diet I'm talking about. That's the problem. So they're making conclusions, some of which seem to be quite valid and impressive and interesting. They're making conclusions by comparing people with a bad diet they're comparing people with a very bad diet against those who are consuming a bad diet.
What?
They're not actually including in that study at all any of the people, you know, who are consuming whole food plant-based diets. It's very simple.
Well, let's try to squeeze in a call before the end of the half hour. Welcome to Health Watch. You're on the air with T. Colin Campbell.
Yes, thank you so much. Can both of you gentlemen hear me all right?
We can. We only have a couple minutes, so if you could make your question short, that would be great.
All right. So I actually have two questions. My first question is, I think on all the rat studies, there's something important that's never done in America. This is actually fundamental. I think the rat studies, first of all, I do agree with you on whole foods. That's fundamental. But on the rat studies, they never do rat studies that have mercury fillings in the rat's teeth. And I wish the cable could do quite a few programs about the problem of mercury fillings and detoxing. I've been so sick with mercury poisoning and being detoxing for months and finally doing better. And it's huge nutritional.
I'm going to have to step in and thank you for the call, but that's a little bit off topic for today, but thank you again for calling. So, T. Colin Campbell, let's finish the show with your final thoughts for our listeners. Oops. Do we still have our guest or have we lost him for the day? Oh, well, looks like we may have lost our guest for the end of the program, but most likely we are going to have Michael Pollan here next week on Health Watch to talk about cooked. He had to reschedule from last week, and I believe he's going to air next Monday. And if we get T. Colin Campbell back on the phone, we'll have him say a couple final words. Are we getting him back on? No, it doesn't look like we're getting him back on. So we'll just go with the music. And thanks for listening to Health Watch, and stay tuned for the rest of the Monday morning radio zine.
The 2013 Yogathon is here, and KABU is a co-sponsor. Living Yoga is holding its fourth annual Yogathon during the months of April and May. Individuals and groups are creating their own personal yoga challenges. They're attending classes at several participating yoga studios in the Portland area, and friends and family are sponsoring their efforts. Living Yoga is awarding prizes to the top individual and team. All of this is to help benefit Living Yoga, a nonprofit program bringing yoga to people in drug and alcohol recovery, incarceration, or who are accessing community transitional services. More information about this six-week-long event can be found at living-yoga.org.
Hi, everyone. Dan Johnson for Radio Zine. My guest today is George Estreich. George is a writer, at-home dad. They live in Western Oregon. George lives with his wife, Teresa, oldest daughter, Ellie, and youngest daughter, Laura, about whom this book is written. George has a BA from the University of Virginia and an MFA from Cornell. George has published two books, Textbook Illustrations of the Human Body, a collection of poetry, and The Shape of the Eye, a book about his youngest daughter, Laura, who has Down syndrome. Now, I need to tell you that The Shape of the Eye was awarded the 2012 Oregon Book Award in Creative Nonfiction. And just recently, I heard The Shape of the Eye appears as the lead four-star review and pick of the week in the April 29 issue of People magazine, which is on sale now, and they call the book an elegantly written, unsentimental memoir. And George joins me in the studio right now. Thank you, George, very much for being here. Let's talk about this darling little kid named Laura.
Sounds good, Dan. Thanks for having me here.
Why don't you kick things off first with this reading, a part of the introduction, because I think within the introduction itself, it's going to set the tone for a lot of things that you may experience or may have experienced in those years in raising Laura, who is now 12?
She's 12 years old now, that's right.
Okay. And it'll help in terms of folks who are listening that may have a child with Down syndrome or know of someone with Down syndrome, and some of the things that parents may actually have thought during that period of time.
Thanks, Dan. And this is from the introduction, and this is talking about my very first reaction to the diagnosis. Nobody, so far as I know, finds out that a newborn child has Down syndrome, shrugs, and returns to decorating the nursery. We were undone by the news for a long time. If Down syndrome were ordinary in the world, if a common sense view of dignity and personhood and capability prevailed, then perhaps our early days would have been easier. But Down syndrome is not ordinary in the world. I kept looking things up, against whispers in my own brain, against shocked silence, against the raw unfamiliarity of our newest family member. I turned to fact. I felt not just ignorant, but culpably ignorant. And yet in my reading, I only found my own confusion writ large. I felt that Laura's life was valuable, that she was a child, a sister and daughter and granddaughter above all, that she might learn and thrive. I also felt that our lives were over, that her birth was a tragedy, and that we were condemned to a half-life of hospitals, acronyms, therapists, and forms. In my unhinged research, I discovered that everything was true. She was a child first, but of course she could have this problem and this one and this one and this one. Or the big list came first, typically framed as they. They have heart defects, intestinal atresias, low IQs, joint problems, and on and on. Oh, but they're happy little tykes. None of it made sense. I did not see how a child could be happy if she had so many problems. I did not see how, with so many problems, she could be a child first. I'd sought refuge in fact, like someone who ducks into a cathedral for quiet, and instead finds an echo chamber for every footfall. Or I was the echo chamber, thronged with a dense collision of numbers and hope and resignation. There were, it seemed, two kinds of stories told about my daughter. In one, she seemed to be a developing child. In the other, she seemed not even human. She was a defect, a tragedy, an abnormality. I did not see how she could be both. It was as if Teresa had given birth to a blur.
A defect, a blur, an abnormality. Those are pretty strong words, but these are the words that you felt in the early days.
That's right. And part of what I do in this book is to I took this as a starting point, this idea of a blur, like how do I hold in vision the fact that I have this lovely daughter, because she did charm us from the very start. And my ideas about Down syndrome, which I didn't even know I had, but had somehow inhaled from the culture, this idea of defectiveness, and how were both possible to be true. And so the book is partly about my working through that contradiction and coming to see Laura clearly, but also coming to see the history of Down syndrome more clearly. Abnormality, defect, and so on, these are the words often used to talk about Down syndrome, even in supposedly neutral situations. And so this was, I was kind of spitting the culture back out is a good way to put it.
Before we delve further into the day-to-day life of living with a child with Down syndrome, let's talk a little bit about the illness itself. How does it come about? Where in the scheme of things genetically does it fit? And give us sort of an